Yes, John Newman, no middle name, 17946, and I was born in Woking, believe it or not.
So how old are you now?
64 and a bit, coming up for my pension in a few months' time.
And you've been retired from Bass for how long?
I retired in 2002.
So. Which was slightly early then, was it?
Yes, I took the opportunity of early retirement. I actually retired at 56. I found out that there was, after 55, you could leave and get paid a pension as if you had retired at 60, the normal time. And obviously you get a slightly lower pension by retiring early, but why not go? I'd probably had enough by then.
Of the job or of Bass?
The job was fantastic. I loved the job. I loved going down south and all the rest of it. But the bureaucracy back in Cambridge was beginning to be overwhelming. Everybody says the same. I'm sure they do. When you interview them, I'm sure they say, you know, the bureaucracy was just getting so much that it seemed to hinder you purposely from getting on with what you had to do. And I just had enough of it. I think I'd been doing it for so long. And, you know, you can only spend so many years of your summers and winters and the rest of it going off down to the Antarctic in the winter here, coming back in the summer and working like blazes and finding out that life is slipping by you and you're devoting it all to the job and not getting any free time, as it were. Mm. So,
can you put your finger on what it was that changed over that period of time, that why the culture at Bass changed?
I think the underlying culture in Bass was always the same. You know, let's go for it, get it done. You know, let's put some effort in and get it done and dusted. But the administration via NERC and auditors and all these sort of people put clamps on what you wanted to do. You had to get approval for this and approval for that, and it had to be planned in. And you had to get so many quotes and go out to tender for every last little thing. It just slowed the whole process down to a crawl.
Was this because it was all government money and had to?
Oh, sure, yes. Yeah. Yes, it was government money. But, I mean, when I first joined Bass, we worked in London then, and it was, you'd go south, you'd visit bases, review their operation, etc. You could see where improvements were needed or vital bits were required. You'd come back, find out what was available, bang an order in and get it ready for shipping. Because that was the criteria. It has to be on that ship. And time evaporates in the summer. You might not get back until April, shall we say, late March, April. And then you've got to have things in the packing store by end of August. So you've got to go like the clappers. And if you've got to go through approval processes and tenders and all the rest of it, it does really put the mockers on it a bit. But when we first were there, you'd go down, you'd see what was required, you'd come back, you would find out what was available yourself, you'd generate the order yourself, mm-hmm. you'd perhaps supervise it through the packing process, and it would be on the ship. But there were other people who had to be inserted into the process so that you could not generate a requirement yourself and order it yourself and see it packed yourself, because you could be in collusion with a supplier, you could be shipping it to your own back garden or who knows what. But
so had the trust gone then?
Well, of course, in the early days, of course, it was very much an expedition mentality. you do it, and you do it yourself, and you see it through. But as soon as you get the organisation starts to expand, then the bureaucracy starts, and I don't think it was a thing of trust. I think it was just fulfilling what was necessary in the public domain for purchasing. It was a whole new department created. We used to do exactly what they did, do it on the side. And yet there was a whole new department created for purchasing. And that's when it started to become more and more bureaucratic.
Do you think the bureaucracy began to get in the way of achieving the science?
I don't think so, no. Of course, I was always on the services side in one way or another. I think the scientists had generally a bit simpler requirements than we had. You know, we might be putting in a generator installation or something, whereas they might have just a little box of tricks or something, which was probably equally valuable, certainly to them. But they could perhaps organise it much earlier than we could. Mm. Remember, we were dealing with all the bases. It wasn't just one base or one project that we were dealing with. We had all the bases to deal with. Had to meet all their needs, all their supplies, all their spares, all their project requirements. And, you know, so many balls in the air at any one time that, you know, it was a bit amazing that we managed to pull it off.
So the logistics became illogical?
Became frustrating, I would say, rather than illogical. It was logical from their point of view. You know, they were making sure that public money was safeguarded. But it didn't make getting it on that ship any easier.
Let's go back to the beginning then. Thank you for that assessment of the circumstances of why you decided to go to retirement.
I'm sure a lot of people have said the same thing. You know, the whole, you're mired in bureaucracy eventually. You can't, no matter how important it is, you can't go ahead because you haven't got a signature on the particular form or something.
I don't think Bass was unique in that, was he, really?
No.
Tell me about your education. What sort of school did you go to in Surrey?
Oh, village school. We were in the first village outside of London, the first proper village.
And what was it called?
Chobham. There was a 3-mile gap between the sprawl from London came down the railway line to Woking, and there was a 3-mile gap of open, unbuilt countryside between us and them. And it was a proper village. They had farmers and nurserymen and agricultural shows and all the rest of it of their own. So it was, at that time, a proper village. I believe it's all antique shops now. but that's only to be expected.
Were you good at school?
Secondary school, I think I was probably quite good at. But all the schools were in the village. Mm. Infant school, junior school, and secondary school was all in the village.
But did you choose not to go to further education, to go to college or university? Or?
I must admit I deliberately failed the 11 plus. School was 50 yards from home, and I used to see, you know, it's probably twisted thinking at that time, but you think it is now, but at that time, as a child, you're not aware of what education is going to lead to fully and how to achieve it. Nobody ever explained the education system to us. You know, you get this exam and you can move here and move there, you know, go to this college or this school with these particular qualifications. We were just educated to a rough standard by, you know, the same set of teachers all the way through. But the 11 plus I deliberately flunked because I could see the people coming back from the local grammar school, about 4 or 5 miles away. They come in, they come on public buses, you know, and they'd arrive. I'd been at home for an hour and a half or 2 hours or something, and they pull through the village with the windows all steamed up, and they just rub a little hole and all these miserable faces looking out, and I thought, that is not for me. But probably mistakenly. But certainly moving on to secondary school, they didn't do GCSEs at all. They didn't do them. So that really would put the mockers on any education beyond that. We were dumped. We failed the 11 plus, so they had to do something with us. So they popped us into this secondary school and gave you probably not very good education, looking back on it. I can read and write and do maths and simple maths and the rest of it, but very little else. So they didn't really stretch themselves to.
However, you did become an apprentice, didn't you, John?
Yes, I did. Hmm. I got that myself. I mean, I ought to say that at this stage, my parents were not interested in what my education was, or they didn't give me any advice. They didn't say, "Oh, you ought to look at this job or that job." It was up to me to choose, and I chose, and I managed to get an apprenticeship at a local government establishment. It was they dealt with research on fighting vehicles. It was only a mile and a half away, very convenient, and I must admit I had a superb apprenticeship.
This was at FVRDE. What does that stand for?
Fighting Vehicles Research and Development Establishment.
Right.
It's quite a big place. They dealt with everything from motorcycles to tanks. So got a shot at working on everything.
Had you been a mechanically minded lad?
Yes, my father ran a garage in the village, you know, and but he had been a proper engineer in his time before he dealt with that. He was trained at Thornycrofts in Basingstoke, and he was a very clever man. He was very good on machines and with his hands and the rest of it. He set up an engineering business in the war and made bits for radar sets. He had no idea what they were. He was supplied with a drawing of an anonymous bit, and he made the bits. And it wasn't until after the war that he learned that these bits went into radar sets, and that's what he did in the war. He worked day and night making. I think he had 12 women working for him on machines, doing these bits. And, you know, he was good at it.
So you were kind of picking up the basics of mechanical engineering at his elbow, more or less?
Yes, I would say so, yeah.
Yeah.
I had a fair idea of...
So why was this apprenticeship so valuable to you? Why was it so good?
Oh, they put you through every department. I spent a year standing at a bench, filing and fitting metal. That's a whole year doing, learning how to use your hands, basically. And, you know, no private enterprise would be able to do that unless they're extremely large. I mean, employ somebody just to stand there and file metal for a year. You know, it was very good. You know, I had sufficient accuracy to work to a couple of tenths of thousandths of an inch just from my hands. And, you know, I've still got it to some extent.
What was your first awareness that there was a place called the Antarctic?
Well, we'd all heard of Captain Scott and all the rest of it. We didn't know much about it. When I was at technical college, near the end of my time, there was a notice on the notice board asking for volunteers to go on the Cambridge-Spitsbergen expedition. They wanted a couple of mechanics to look after their boat engines. And I went on that in one summer. And the next summer at college, there was another notice on the board saying, you know, British Antarctic Survey wants mechanics and engineers and for service in the Antarctic. So I've seen one end, I might as well go and see the other. And that's exactly what I did.
Was there something about cold climates that attracted you?
No. No.
Or the environments of the two polar areas?
No, I was struck by the scenic beauty of Spitsbergen and the remoteness, and there's quite a lot of history up there as well. I was struck by that, and I thought it could only be bigger down at the other end. So I was, you know, I wanted to go and see what the Antarctic was like.
So you applied, effectively?
Yes, yeah.
How was that? What do you remember about the process of applying and being interviewed?
I think I took the address off the notice board and phoned them up or wrote to them, and they sent me an application form, filled it in. I didn't realise then that they were in a desperate hurry, because it was about early August, I think, when I was interviewed. And we sailed in mid-September. Now I know, of course, that they had nobody to send, and I applied, and they thought, gosh, you know, somebody wants to go, send them.
Do you remember who was on the panel that interviewed you?
Yes, Bill Sloman and Paul Whiteman. And it took place in a little cubbyhole under the stairs in Gillingham Street in London. A little slopey place. They were crouched in there. I was crouched in there as well. And
would you say it was a rigorous interview, or...?
No, not really. Yeah. I've done interviewing myself as well, and you cannot really test anybody's work ability. You're taking their qualifications at face value, and the experience they tell you you've had, they tell you they've had. And, of course, you take up references if necessary. But you're judging the personality. Remember, they've got to fit in to, you know, perhaps 10 or 15 people over the winter. They've got to be the sort of person that fits in with all the rest of them. And you're judging that almost as much as their technical abilities.
So there's a kind of a subtle psychological testing going on, is there?
I think
that's sort of a grand phrase, but you get...
Yes. I don't know what it is, but all the people are obviously we made a couple of mistakes in our time interviewing, but generally, British people, you can interview them and they'll come across as quite reasonable people. You can send them on something like this and they'll fit in without any trouble. And yet the Americans, perhaps, I don't know, they employ very many more people, but they go in for interviews and psychological testing and all sorts of rigmaroles, and they get all sorts of rather strange characters giving them bother. But say a 25-minute interview for the people we want, and I think it's in the national character, and they just go down and fit in. It works.
So, what's interviewing? I know we're moving forward again in time. What was the interviewing you were doing? Were you recruiting for Bass?
Yes, mechanics and mechanics, plumbers, tractor makes, diesel makes, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Much later in your career.
Oh yes. Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah, much later. Yeah. But I had no specific training or instruction on interviewing. You would just say, you know, we're interviewing for such and such. Off you go. And it takes you a little while to learn about it. I wish I'd had some instruction.
So when they said, OK, John, you're heading south in 6 weeks' time...
Yes.
How did that feel?
Well, a bit strange, really. I think, you know, well, you know, what have I done? What have I done?
How old were you?
22.
Were you leaving anybody?
I was 21 when I was interviewed and 22 when I left.
Were you leaving somebody special behind at that point in your life?
Not particularly, no.
And what about the MOD? How did they react?
Oh, I'd I'd done a year after my apprenticeship. I stayed on for a year.
So you were clear?
I was clear, yes.
Yeah.
And I just resigned and off they went. Off we went.
So you went up to Girton College for the conference?
It was Corpus Christi in those days. All a bit strange.
Why was it strange?
Oh, never experienced that sort of environment before at all. Quite an eye-opener, really, as to how these... Of course, it was in the summer. There weren't any students there. But living in student accommodation, dining in hall and the rest of it. And, you know, thought, my goodness, don't they have a jolly good time? Yeah, of course, it was free then. Didn't have to pay anything. But, yes, that was quite an experience. And then it wasn't long before sailing day.
How did you get on? Because there you were, as a man who worked with his hands, a mechanical engineer, and you were in the food queue with quite eminent young scientists, weren't you? And met man and
yes,
biologists. So yes. Did you all gel?
At the conference, I'm not quite sure. It's rather a lot of years ago, but I think we all got on quite well. Yes. But I mean, the real shaking down takes place when you sail on the ship.
And you went on the Bisco.
I did. Yes, I'd never. I think I'd seen a picture of the Bisco or whatever it is. But when I turned up at Southampton docks, and there was the top of the mast sticking above the dock side, and you walk to the edge and look down on the ship, and you think, oh my goodness. We've got to go all that way in this tiny thing.
Had you sailed much before?
No.
Not at Spitsbergen?
Well, it was a commercial ferry across to Bergen, and then took the coastal steamer up to Tromsø. That was fantastic. And then a very small ship up to Spitsbergen. I didn't find any trouble with that at all. No trouble whatsoever. And
The Bisco has a rough ride, doesn't it?
Bisco used to roll like the very devil. And I felt very ill, I'm afraid. Very ill. I don't think I appeared until some distance south of the Bay of Biscay. This pasty white figure appeared on deck. And everybody blinked and said, oh my God, who's that? And it was me.
Were you...
I'm so seasick all the time. I gradually got used to it a bit.
Did you have any doubts at that point?
Probably, but I don't remember them.
Oh.
You know, they're probably reasonably slight. I think you realise that people have done this for quite a number of years, and they have obviously survived, so no reason why you shouldn't survive.
The ship actually ran into problems, didn't it? Mechanical problems whilst it was taking you south.
Yes, I believe the guy had a leak in the stern gland, which necessitated them going into dry dock in Montevideo. Which was probably great for the people that were there. I only got 3 days there in Montevideo. The others, the people that left behind, got 2 weeks there. I think.
Why were you shortchanged?
Well, no, I wasn't shortchanged. We were only going to be there about that time anyway. They wanted to open up Deception Island. Open it up for the air, staging through with aeroplanes. But they also wanted to shut the base down itself because it was abandoned the previous February. The previous November. Due to an eruption, and the place was just left, and they wanted it sort of tidied up and closed up properly and secured, and that was that. So they needed a mechanic, and they asked me, would you be willing to go down there? And Endurance was just about to leave to go to Stanley and then on down, so I shipped aboard Endurance. which was the first year of the endurance, and fine, great. We slept in the forward hold. There was about three or four of us went, slept in the forward hold. Had a very good time, actually. Got dropped off at Deception, and we carried on.
Well, you went to Stanley first, didn't you?
Yes, we went through Stanley.
Tell me the story of that. Oh, as you say, Endurance was newly commissioned.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they sailed into Stanley. This was marvellous. And, of course, sailing into Stanley, all the crew line up on the upper decks, you know, and all stand in lines and salute and wave hats and all the rest of it. We were invited to join them. We came through the Narrows and started to chug up the harbour towards Stanley itself. And behind Endurance, a little red ship appeared, zoomed through the Narrows, overtook Endurance. It was Shackleton, the original Shackleton for Bass. And I think Endurance said, "Oh, this is our first visit. Please give us priority." And virtually Shackleton stuck two fingers up at them, screamed past them, and did a sort of handbrake stop against the public jetty. And they were up in the globe by the time Endurance had anchored.
Do you know who the captain was of the...
Yes, Captain Turnbull. He used to go by the name Frosty. Yeah. Very good. I don't think he got on with the Navy much, and he was just delighted to be able to put one over on them. But they came in, all this saluting and flags going up and down and little cannons being fired and all the other sort of cobblers that they get up to. Very instructive.
You were at Stanley for 10 days or so, Hall, heading off, and there was some Argentinian activity.
Yes, there was. During our time there, there was one of these flights. It was a private plane, actually. It wasn't government, Argentine government-sponsored or anything. I think they were newspaper people. And they got this small twin-engined plane and decided to fly to the Falklands. There was about five people on it. And, of course, after the previous incident when the DC-3 came down on the race course there, they blocked the race course off. There were, you know, all sorts of entanglements and bits and pieces blocking the race course off. So they got there and found that they couldn't land, and they searched around, went about 5 miles outside of Stanley and picked a straight bit of gravel road and tried to land on it. And they ran off and crunched it up in the ditch. But they all got out of it and the rest of it. And I think everybody jumped in Land Rovers and roared out there. And I think we were pretty soon on the scene. But it was surrounded by Falkland Islands Defence Force people who sort of ringed it and had guns trained on them and the rest of it. And these people staggered out. And, you know, they weren't any threat to anybody. They just decided to make a point. And
so there was a definite motive, was there?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They wanted to make a point that they could fly there. And there might have been some anniversary involved as well, but I wasn't entirely clear. And I'd just bought a new camera. Just bought a brand new camera in the town a few days beforehand. And I'd put the film in and all the rest properly, so I thought. But when I got out there, all the sprocket holes ripped in my film. And the chap I was with, he had his camera, and he managed to sell his film to a newspaper. Not that I wanted to do that, but, you know, sod's law says all the sprocket holes rip in your film, and it's important.
What happened to the five Argies then on the plane? Were they arrested, or...?
Oh, yes. Yes, they were carted off. And I don't... Obviously, they weren't badly treated, and I think they were popped onto a... The Darwin used to run in those days between Stanley and Montevideo. I think probably quite likely they were just put on the Darwin and sent to Montevideo. So, bye-bye.